Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast. One podcast, three women, and a whole load of badass. This is the best of our radio show with me, Harriet Minter, Emma Sexton. Natalie Campbell is away this week, trekking up a mountain somewhere. So instead, we have the fantastic Harry Hall joining us. We are talking to the authors of the new Black Girl Bible, Slay in Your Lane, plus our review of the news this week, and a little musical interlude to send you on your way. 1, 2, 3, 4! Starting us off, it is, of course, our news of the week. The stories that we have been talking about all week. We've got to kick off with the anti-Trump marches yesterday. Harry, were you there?
Of course I was. along with 100,000, I think, other people.
Wow.
It was incredible. Actually, quite different from any other march I'd ever been on, I would say, without hesitation. It was an amazing vibe. The sun was shining. There was music. There was no negativity, no violence, no kettling, I believe. Had an absolutely amazing time. I was obviously there for work as well, though, so reporting for The Independent. So that kind of takes a bit of the fun out, I suppose, because you're doing it for work. But yeah, it was incredible.
So I went, and one of the things that I noticed as I was walking along were all these people kind of standing in the middle or on the sides with, you know, cameras on selfie sticks trying to get pictures. I was like, oh, the life of a reporter. Emma, did you go?
No, I didn't. I was actually at Latitude Festival, but it was interesting because lots of people were nodding to Trump being in town. Mm-hmm. Lots of people had banners. I watched Solange, and Solange did, well, she basically said, go away, Trump, not quite so politely. So there was definitely like a nod to it, but no, I didn't. But I was going to ask you two what you thought about the inflatable Donald Trump.
So it's actually on the TV screen behind you right now. So when I saw it at the march, I felt like it fitted. It really fitted. It felt like it was a sort of beacon that everyone was following. I don't know that I loved it as an image. I felt it was a bit naive, a bit crude, but it really did feel, it did feel a bit like a beacon. That's what it felt like when I was there. Harry, you liked it, didn't you?
I loved the Trump blimp, I have to say. Maybe I'm very juvenile in my humour. That probably speaks volumes. I think there's something really powerful about humour as a weapon against somebody like Trump, mm-hmm. because so many people have been affected in the most horrifying ways, from immigration to abortion. You know, people were really talking about quite serious issues when I interviewed them on the march. And yet above everyone was this hilarious, grotesque, enormous, impossible to miss blimp. And I think even though maybe it's a bit crude, it sends a kind of real message. It's that kind of British humour, I think.
Yeah. Not a fan?
Well, do you know what? Not really, because Trump is vulgar. He's done some awful things, but I just felt like it wasn't like clever humour. Like I get, when you see some of these comedians doing stuff, and when they've been really clever with their humour and they put something in different context that really makes you think about that issue, I think that's super powerful. For me, that was just kind of mocking somebody else, and I just feel like that's just not the way we're going to create change. It's just like, I don't know, it didn't sit comfortably with me at all. But I am getting old now.
Do you think the march will create change? Because that was something that I was, I guess, a bit dubious of before I went, and after, to be honest. I don't know how much change is going to come from it. What did you think?
I don't know. I think they do. I think that it does, because I've always been a big believer in You can feel really helpless when you see somebody who's in a position of power doing things. But when you get a load of people together, you realise how powerful the 1+1 can be in terms of creating a movement. I saw that the Women's Equality Party actually did a thank you card to Trump because they've had the most sign-ups ever, because his behaviour is so awful, but it is being a real catalyst for people going, do you know what, we're not going to put up with this. So I'm you know, the internal optimist.
Because I went along feeling a bit sort of, you know, it's been a kind of a bit of a toxic week politically generally, I think. And I went along feeling a bit over all politics and very much like that person standing by themselves thinking, well, there's nothing I can do as an individual. And it definitely cheered me, definitely made me feel like I wasn't so alone. But I don't know what happens next.
It was such a positive atmosphere, actually. And I was quite surprised by that, because there is a real sort of vitriol against Trump. And I do think marches like that, especially ones like that, that are so positive, have a really galvanizing sort of unifying impact. And perhaps it's not going to change the fact that Trump is president. But it really does show, you look out, you know, at one point I was standing kind of at the top of Trafalgar Square looking out, and I was just really overwhelmed with how many people had come out together, how nobody was disagreeing, how everybody kind of had taken humour in it. And yet, you know, I knew that if I turned to my right, turned to my left, somebody would think the same things. And that's a kind of amazing thing, because a movement can be born out of that as well, I think. And, you know, it's just like the pussy hats in the Women's March. It was this amazing image. So perhaps not directly, immediately an impact, but I think long term.
Our next story this week, Emma, what is it?
Well, we have to talk about the ultimate badass, Serena Williams.
Oh, love her.
Oh, unfortunately, she lost today. But I mean, just an incredible woman. But there's been a lot of talk this week about her, and talking about the fact that she is coming back from having a baby, and lots of talk around her and motherhood. And there was an interesting tweet that she did this week, which was all about how she missed her daughter's first steps because she was training. And that was a really powerful tweet to a lot of mums who are sort of tormented with, you know, going to work and looking after their kids. But I don't know what you thought about, I don't know, should we talk a lot about Serena's motherhood journey? Because do we do that with guys? You know, are we talking about Roger Federer had like twins during one set? Were we talking about that in the same way?
For me, I suppose, as somebody with no knowledge, awareness or understanding of tennis, I adore Serena and Venus. And actually the fact that she took part in the Australian Open pregnant, I mean, that's a lot to talk about. That's more interesting than, you know, Roger Federer having twins, I think, for me. Her story is obviously not kind of applicable to many women, and she's got a lot more money, a lot more resources, but she really is a powerhouse and a huge inspiration. So, yeah, I think so.
And I really like it when people normalize feelings that we all have that sometimes we feel like we can't talk about. So I know lots of my friends who had kids would feel that they could not say publicly, I missed my child's first steps. They would just feel that saying that would make everyone think they were such a terrible mother, and they would feel real guilt about it. And Serena coming out and saying, I missed my child's first steps, I do feel guilty about it, but the reality is this is my life. I think that is such a powerful statement about accepting that life, particularly if you want to play at that level, life is a series of trade-offs, and we have to make those.
It is, but there's two things that jar with me. One, the fact that I've never seen any other professional sports man talk about how he has missed out on his children's moments because he's been training. So one, I'm like, why is this, you know, why is this an issue for women? Why are women feeling all this guilt about not being there? And two, you know, she's come back 10 months after she's given birth, which on the one hand is phenomenal. But on the other hand, it's like, is that not enormous pressure to put on new mums who have had a baby and are still getting to grips with that newborn baby? You know, we have to remember that Serena has lots of money. She has lots of support. So there's these two things that I just feel like I don't know. I don't feel like that's helping women. I feel like it's feeding into this narrative that women are already having to deal with.
But I think if we don't talk about the narrative, then it just becomes oppressive. And that for me is the thing, which is actually when we talk about it, then we get the debate which says, well, hang on, why does no man ever say this? Why is it just women? And then we start talking about, okay, well, if women feel this, what else are they feeling that we're not taking into consideration in the norm? Whereas if we live in this world where we just pretend everything is totally 100% at all times, I don't think that's the reality for men or women. And that to me feels more dangerous in terms of moving us forward than just being honest about your experience.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree, actually. I did feel there was something in the dispelling of this myth that women could have it all when Serena posted that tweet, because we are told, you know, we either have it all or we have nothing. Yeah. But, you know, what is this idea of having it all? Is it being Serena Williams, winning, you know, Wimbledon, being a mother, being hugely successful? Well, actually, to have her say, I've missed something and that's been hard, even though I've got this amazing success, that is quite humbling. And it is quite comforting, I suppose, because you're always going to drop a ball somewhere. And I don't think men are faced with this
men are never even asked if they're having it all. That's the thing that winds me up, because it's like, you know, yeah, I'm with you, Harry, in terms of like saying honestly how you feel and getting a conversation around it. But, you know, there's whole debates about Serena's not able to have it all. No, again, no single male sports player has ever had an article going, oh yeah, I mean, poor Harry Kane can't have it all, can he? You know, he's had to be in the world.
But
he can't.
Interestingly, there was a big furor. Sorry, people, don't hate me. I'm not up with the World Cup and who all the players are. But there was a big to-do about Gareth Southgate sending one of his players home during the World Cup to be with his wife who's giving birth. And yeah, he was like, get out here and go. And that, for me, was really interesting because, I mean, previously, not only would that never have happened, like they would just been like, no, you're at the World Cup, she gives birth alone. Certainly, we wouldn't have talked about it as whether that was a good decision or not. So I do think things are starting to change.
Yeah, but that footballer's still not going to be asked, can you have it all?
But he should be, quite frankly. So this is the other thing, which is the reason we don't have those conversations with men is because men are brought up, sorry for speaking on your behalf, guys, feel free to disagree with me. Men are brought up to think that their number one duty is economic responsibility. And so long as they are bringing home the bacon, they are doing their job. And nobody asks them, actually, do you feel a bit sad that you missed out on your kid's childhood?
Well, I tell you what, seeing as I'm in a room with two journalists who have a lot of influence in mainstream media, maybe you could do those articles. Well, what do you think, ladies? Just a little
idea.
I did want
to say, you know, I think, I mean, thank you. I'll try my best. I do want to say, you know, I think it's very difficult because obviously there's a biological difference between a man as a father and a woman as a mother, and a woman needing to, you know, leave work for however long, you know, she deems necessary following birth to breastfeed if she wants to, etc. And then that's sort of embroiled within the gender pay gap and going back to work and wondering if you have a job. And so actually, even though we talk about, you know, men aren't asked this question of can you have it all, really we should be talking about maybe we should get to a stage where they can be asked that question, where we have equal paternity, maternity leave and equal pay, because then it kind of wraps it all up in one. Whereas at the moment, there is this weight on women because of that, because you do have to leave work and do all of that and come back and then try and balance. So you've already sort of formed that relationship almost, you know, more than the father.
And Harry, you raised an interesting point, which is that even when we allow for men doing kind of equal parenting and think of them as co-parents rather than just fathers who go out to work and never see their kids, they're still not doing the same emotional labour as women. What do you mean by that?
So, yeah, there's this talk of this phrase emotional labour, which sort of, you know, in a nutshell, what it means is the things outside of, you know, the dishes, the childcare, the earning of the money, things like remembering your friend's birthday, getting the Christmas presents, you know, the things that, you know, might kind of roll over in women's heads all the time. I'm not saying they don't roll over in men's heads, but, you know, countless surveys have shown, including men and women, that there is a discrepancy there. And so on top of this, you know, tick, 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 I've done all of these things that, you know, are on my chore list this week, I do think women have this additional sort of responsibility almost that you know, isn't falling to men, perhaps all men in the same way.
Emma, what do you think? Do you think men are not that good at emotional labour, or do you think it's that women just pick it up automatically?
No, I think guys are like, what's the immediate priority? And I kind of feel like, I think it's differences. I think that as a woman, you might go, oh yeah, I really want to get a card. A guy might not think about that. He's not bothered. So if he's not bothered about sending a card to his family, why are you bothered about sending a card?
But then who would send a card?
Well, I just like, just don't do it. Like, don't pick up after these people. Like, let them take responsibility. Because I just feel like you can just disable people by like picking up after them and doing all this stuff for them. And then it does become you doing it all the time because you're worried about what somebody else is going to think because you didn't get them a card. And like, no, just let it go.
But are you not just worried about? So when I get somebody a card, and I have to admit that I'm actually quite bad at this.
I was going to say it's my birthday this week. Yeah. I ain't got no card.
Where's the card been? I am really bad at it, and it's like a well-known fact amongst my friends that I'm really bad with birthdays. But I always, when somebody sends me a card, I'm like, oh, I'm really touched.
But if it was a male friend, yeah, if it was a male friend who then sends, and his girlfriend sends you a card. I mean, I've got family, my male cousins, and their girlfriends will send my mum and dad a card. And I'm like, mum and dad have never even met their girlfriends.
But this is the thing. So it's not just card. And I apologise in advance to my boyfriend for this. But, you know, my boyfriend's mum will text me over him, not obviously because she prefers me, it's because she knows I'll respond, make sure that, you know, we meet at a certain time or whatever. During the World Cup she was texting me and he was like, hang on a minute, why isn't she texting me? I was like, because you never reply.
But because you
I
reply,
feel there's a responsibility.
And now she always goes to you. True. Where what I would be is like, sweetheart, I don't know why your mum's texting me, but you might want to give her a call.
That is fair.
Well, we really want to know from you, what you think about this, men and women having it all. Give us a call and tell us, 0344 499 1000. Do men have it all and women have nothing, or is it round the wrong way? Have we all got it wrong? So our next story, Harry, you are talking about Superman. Tell us about it.
Yes, so it's another unfortunate, very tone deaf Hollywood man's response to the Me Too movement. That's all I can say so
far.
Let me
guess. Let me guess. He's worried about chatting up women.
Tick. So, yes, Henry Cavill of Superman fame this month had an interview in Australian GQ. And he essentially, to sum up, said that he felt like he couldn't talk to women anymore because, quote, he might get called a rapist or something.
Oh.
So just to give you the quote in full.
I mean, he's definitely being called something, isn't he?
Breaking. Just to give you the quote in full, because I always feel like we have these things out of context and then everyone starts kind of lighting their torches and hunting people down. The quote was, he said he thought there was something wonderful about a man chasing a woman in the old traditional way of dating.
With an axe or just like...
a metaphorical chase, a non-physical chase. He was asked about the Me Too movement, which, you know, I think there's really a non-difficult way of responding without sounding like a complete creep. But anyway, he responded by saying, it's very difficult to do that if there are certain rules in place, because then it's like, well, I don't want to go up and talk to her because I'm going to be called a rapist or something. So you're like, forget it. I'm going to call an ex-girlfriend instead and then just go back to a relationship, which never really worked. But it's way safer than casting myself into the fires of hell because I'm someone in the public eye. And if I go and flirt with someone, then who knows what's going to happen?
Oh, my goodness. What can we do with these men? Because, you know, this comes up all the time.
What does it mean? Who knows what's going to happen?
Who knows? Well, he does. And that's the problem, right?
So I think, and I actually want to talk about this. So we're going to talk in a minute about Love Island. Obviously, a little Love Island recap. And I want to talk about it within Love Island as well. But I think there's something for men just understanding what is a yes and what is a no.
Yeah.
Because if you understand what a yes and what a no is, then you can flirt with somebody and know which response you're getting. Just follow that.
I think everybody does know. This is the thing. Yeah. And this is what annoys me about this kind of poor me response from certain men in the industry to the Me Too movement. And by no means all men, because there have been some amazing champions of the movement. But there have been a handful of these kind of misguided, absurd comments like Matt Damon and people saying, oh, what, we're not supposed to flirt with a woman anymore. How can we ask her out? And then these responses from comedians saying, you know, no, you can't, you know, flash yourself to a woman in the workplace, but you can politely say, would you like a coffee? You know, so it's really not hard, and it's never been hard. And it frustrates me to have this whole incredible, hugely important overdue meeting flipped so that now it's about poor men being unable to, you know, chase women down the street and wolf whistle at
them.
But
also, for me, the Me Too movement in particular was much more about power. An imbalance of power and people who were in positions of power using that to be sexually inappropriate or using that. And I think that's the nuance that people are forgetting. I mean, yes, of course you need consent and respect when you are, you know, engaging with other people. But to me, that was the main thing around Me Too. So if you're in a position of power and you are using sex to have influence on somebody else, then yes, it's not okay, mate.
So I think the really interesting question around this is always, particularly in a workplace situation, ask yourself, have you ever hit on somebody at work? And then ask yourself, have you ever hit on somebody more senior than you at work? And see how often the answer to the second one is yes, because it's not going to be that often. And that is where Me Too comes in.
Across the UK, online and on DAB. Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
Now, you might remember a few months ago, the fabulous Natalie Campbell was talking about the book that she thought was going to completely change her life. It was called Slay in Your Lane. It was the Black Girl Bible, and it's written by Yomi Adegoke and Elizabeth Uwe Benene. Ladies, I'm so sorry. I've just tried so hard on those names and I've got them wrong. I know I have, but thank you for joining us so much to talk about the book. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having us.
So, Elizabeth, tell us, what inspired the book?
So essentially I was reading, so back in 2015 I was reading quite a few different books around personal development and career books. It was like a start of the new year. It was like my first kind of like proper graduate job that I had outside university. So one of those books being Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, and it was really, really good. And I felt that there needed to be, I guess, another book written that kind of focused more on Black British women that centered around the workplace, because though the book was really good and I got some really good lessons, it felt to speak to both facets of my identity being a Black woman. So I, after like a really frustrating week, I called Yomi, my best friend, and I knew she had ambitions to write a book one day. And I said to her, I think you should write a book that for me, essentially, because I know you want to buy a book, and I feel like that you should write. But there's so many unwritten rules in a corporate world about getting ahead, and so I think that someone needs to kind of like put this on paper and write it. And in that conversation, we kind of like, by the end of it, we're like, let's do it together, sort of thing. Well, she said she trusted me to say let's do it together, because she's a journalist. So she said, yeah, let's do it together. And honestly, like three years ago, and we're here.
Yomi, that's amazing. What did you think when Elizabeth suggested it? Did you think, yes, this needs to happen? Or you're like, I don't know.
I immediately was like, this is probably one of the best ideas I've ever heard. And quite literally, as she sort of was saying, yeah, I think you should write this book, and like pitching for me to do it, I was like, literally with one hand, like sort of looking like, does anything else like this exist? Because if not, this is actually quite clearly one of like the most important things that could ever happen. And then I always kind of say, like, because it was such a clearly brilliant idea and she was quite literally gifting it to me, I was like, I just kind of had this like quick flash forward of like all these people buying this amazing book and like it being Elizabeth's idea. And then obviously she's like amazing at marketing, like she's a brilliant writer. So I was like, yeah, for the sake of this friendship, like very much to ensure that we still have this friendship in another 8 years' time, let's do it together. And then yeah, it was just so clearly and I suppose so obviously needed, because it was just like once we started researching, you know, sort of Black lean ins, inverted commas, and books that sort of focus on the workplace, it became really quickly apparent that there was nothing like that in sort of any other area. So like dating, health, and that's why it's like the Black Girl Bible. We made it a lot more, yeah, thorough.
So you've expanded out from work to life in general.
Yeah.
Amazing. Harry, did you...
The book covers sort of everything, as you said, from health to finance to education. But what's really interesting to me, something that came out of it, is this concept that you sort of... You talk about this sort of almost equivalent of toxic masculinity for Black women, about this idea of the kind of sassy, quote, sassy Black woman, or this kind of angry or even empowered Black woman, and the pressure that that puts upon Black women. And actually, as a white woman, this isn't something that I had ever heard about or thought about before. And I thought that brought a really amazing, interesting new topic, hugely important topic to the fore. And I wondered sort of, where did it come from to put that in there as well, you know, as everything else? Was that a sort of straight away, this is a massive thing we have to, or were people already talking about it and you felt it needed to be covered more?
Yeah, I think it's something that definitely had been spoken about a lot within the Black community. It's very sort of rare to even come across a Black woman that has never once been accused of sort of being sassy or being angry or having a chip on their shoulder. Even just the other day when, I know you guys were talking about Love Island.
Yes.
Which we adore. there's been a lot of sort of talk about Samira, and when she left, I think Love Island, the actual sort of verified account, sort of said something. When they did their sort of goodbye to her, they quote tweeted it with like, oh, we're going to miss sassy Samira. And everyone was like,
I saw
how
that.
Is she sassy? She's corny, she's funny, she's goofy, she's sweet, but she's not sassy. But it's just that kind of immediate thing of like, you know, as a black woman, you're like sort of massively stronger than everybody else, and you're kind of more willing to withstand sort of bad treatment, and you're more able to. And I think the big issue with that is it's like a double-edged sword, as we say in the book. It's a positive thing at times because it means you kind of become more resilient, but then when you're just having a really bad day and feeling really down, you almost feel like, gosh, I don't want to be the weakest link, the kind of poor black girl that's unlike her peers, able to kind of just get through it.
And it's interesting because it's sort of, you know, this idea of sort of the difference between, you know, white women and, you know, don't cry, you'll be seen as weak. And then actually the what you're talking about and this sort of, you know, this almost pressure on black women to not cry and to be strong was really interesting. And actually what I loved so much about this book is that actually my mum told me about it because she had heard of you guys on Women's Hour and was like, this book sounds amazing. And so it's really something that, you know, everyone should read. And obviously it's a black girl Bible, but I think with these things, you know, feminist books, you know, intersectional feminism, etc., everyone should read them to learn about different experiences. Absolutely. And that's something that I learned from the book that I just hadn't, you know, known about. So yeah, thank you. That's great.
Thank you so much.
You obviously spoke to lots of amazing women and interviewed them for the book. Was there anything that was really surprising out of that? Like when you, you know, when you talked to lots of people, were there any themes that came out that were a bit unexpected? I know you sort of had a vision for the book, but is there anything that came out of those interviews?
Ooh, oh, gosh, we had like so many, different interviews.
39.
Yeah. Wow. So many hours. There wasn't really anything that was... I'm trying to think. Like,
who was your favourite?
Who was my favourite?
Oh, God, this is a harder question than the one before. Yeah. It was just like everyone was so amazing, which sounds like such a cop-out. But Susie, when you're speaking to like Mallory Blackman and like Jamelia and like Karen Blackett.
Yeah, I think we had like our own kind of girl crushes before we kind of, before we started this. And then we kind of introduced each other to like new women as well. And I think that's a big part of the book. We didn't just want to kind of like... show women that everybody else knew, but also kind of reintroduce women to like the British public, but also to our demographic as well. I remember the day that Karen Blackett is a real big idol of mine, obviously working in marketing. So when Yomi told me, oh my God, we've got her, like she got the email, I was like, oh my God, like this was like crazy because she was just such a hero for me. And she obviously writes the foreword of the book. And it was just surreal meeting all these different types of women that like, I could sit there and like literally tell you each and every kind of wonderful part of their interviews, but honestly it's like there was like 39 brilliant women.
And I was just gonna say, sorry, just what you were saying about was anything surprising, I think a lot of it validated more than surprised. The stats were really surprising, because it was like, you know, black women are more likely to die of breast cancer. We were like, whoa, black women are more likely to be like swiped left on dating apps and stuff like that. That was quite like so shocking. But in terms of the women's stories, a lot of the time it was like the same issues that like Margaret Busby, who's one of our oldest interviewees, so she's 73, she looks absolutely amazing. And then like one of our younger interviewees, Florence Adepoju, who's 27 and a beauty entrepreneur, they were kind of talking about the same stuff with literally like 50 year gaps. Wow. Yeah. So yeah. I think it more validated things that we kind of already knew about the black British.
What were some of the things they were talking about? Can you give some examples?
Gosh, I mean, microaggressions, like constant invalidations at the hands of people that weren't necessarily doing it intentionally, being undermined, being sort of undervalued. There was just loads of it.
I remember Margaret Busby said that, so she was kind of like the head of her publishing house. She was like the youngest and the first like person to have her own publishing house, the youngest anyway. And I remember she was saying that her kind of, who was it, the person, her partner sort of, not her business partner, was a white man. And a lot of the time when they'll go to all these meetings, everyone assumed that he was kind of like the head of like the publishing house. And when we did an event last week, gosh, all the days are blurring. And some woman, she's like as small as me. I'm like literally 5 foot. And she was like, everybody, I'm like the head of like investment and this and this. And everyone thinks that it's the other guy who's like taller than me, who's like, you know, the other white guy who's like the head. So it's just very similar kind of like themes around microaggressions and, you know, unconscious bias and all of that sort of stuff. But like Yomi said, it invalidated more than surprised us.
Can I just I just want to rewind back to like when you had the idea and you have a conversation as friends, because I think it's one thing to have an idea, it's absolutely another thing to make it happen, and also to have the amazing success that you're having. Can you tell me what happened next after you had that idea? How did you start to make this happen?
So honestly, as you do, like being a typical millennial, you go on Google. Like honestly, like you just go on Google, and we typed in how to get a book deal, like that straightforward, and it came up with all these links, and one of them saying that one, you need to write a book proposal because book proposals, non-fiction books count on, you know, them understanding that you're proving the market and proving that you can actually it will sell essentially. So we went through all that. We it was like different parts. They were like, oh, you've got to do this, you've got to do this, and we really kind of like took our time, and we spent the like with the whole summer working on it. We did a focus group with our, like, not necessarily our friends, but people we kind of knew, like loosely, different types of black girls, and we kind of pulled them into like a restaurant, and we asked them like, oh, what do you think about our idea and stuff like that. So we did, it was, that proposal was very much, I guess, a lot of where our efforts gone into went into the first couple of months. And then alongside that, it was like, oh, you have to get an agent, because they are like the gatekeepers into the publishing world, yeah. As you guys might know. And as part of that, we were like, oh, do we really want an agent? Because they take, you know, they take a percentage. And we were like, nah, we don't. Let's do it ourselves, because we can, you know, we can do it ourselves. And that quickly died out. So once we kind of realized that that wasn't the case, we were like, cool, we've got our proposal. Let's look for an agent. So that's what was like the next step. Yeah. So it was very weird. We kind of like took it like very methodologically in terms of like, this is what we need to do, just because of the internet is such a good source of information.
Yeah. Amazing.
I love that. How do I write a book? I'm just going to check with Google. Google or no.
Harry.
I also wanted to ask you both, sort of, you know, you've got this amazing friendship relationship that's really come across in, you know, comes across in the book and has come across in all your interviews. You know, and a lot of the questions are, you know, have you argued, blah, blah, blah. But yeah. Actually, I don't want to ask that, because, you know, that's always a thing that would obviously be asked of two women, you know, have you bickered?
Very
but
true.
Actually, what I want to know is, how did your kind of different skill sets complement each other? Because I know, Elizabeth, you work in marketing, and Yomi, you're a journalist. So yeah. How did they fit together in this project?
God, I think it was just perfect. Honestly, I think that we both had a very sort of clear vision for how we wanted it to be. We knew that we wanted it to be to immediately speak to sort of black women first, but also to be mainstream and to be something that we felt that allies and people from outside different communities would also be interested in. So I think that's like a real sort of big part where Elizabeth's sort of marketing expertise came in, because I think the sort of success that we've had just isn't an accident. The sort of like, we sort of walked past Foyles in Stratford and had like this massive window display, and it's like all these little books, and it says, you know, the Black Girl Bible with this sort of massive poster, and we're like, it's just unprecedented. But it's because we've sort of, because of Elizabeth's marketing expertise, we were able to sort of create something that we knew would speak to people outside of our community. And just, it's just a good looking book, like the whole campaign,
it is a great,
it's a gorgeous book, right?
Yeah.
And like the whole campaign, we wanted it to be sort of like engaging and interesting, and that even if you're outside of that demographic, like, you know who Jamelia is, you know who Vanessa Kingori is, lots of people, or even if you didn't, yeah, you'd be interested in who the, you know, publishing director of Vogue was. And then obviously, you know, writing's my trade, and that, and Elizabeth, I think a lot of confidence was like sort of,
yeah, passed over
because I'd read her work before and been like, oh, you can write, and then would like sort of help with like reading over stuff and editing. And yeah, I think it just fit perfectly. Yeah.
So we are going to find out more from Elizabeth about exactly how to market a book, because you've done it brilliantly. Coming up here on Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
One, two, three, four!
Welcome back to Badass Women's Hour XL with me, Harriet Minter, Emma Sexton, and this week, the fabulous Harry Hall. Before the break, we were talking to the authors of the Black Girl Bible, Slay in Your Lane, Yomi Adeyoke and Elizabeth Uwe-Benene. How close was that? Was it close?
Very close.
Okay. Very, yeah.
Yes.
Well done.
About their book, Slay in Your Lane, which has... It's everywhere. And I'm so, and we did talk about what beautiful cover, and it is a beautiful cover. Yeah, so an excellent choice on the hot pink. It's everywhere because of some brilliant marketing, I think, Elizabeth.
And publicity from our amazing publicist, yeah. Naomi Mantin. She's amazing.
Yeah, but so you keep dodging this. You clearly had a really great strategy around it. Did you see this and be like, I think I can make this work. I think I can sell it.
If I'm so honest, when we first had that conversation back in 2015, that was the part that interested me the most. Like, yeah. The writing bit didn't seem real because I thought, I don't necessarily do that for a living. And Yomi had to kind of like sell the whole, oh, like it's going to be a campaign bit. And that's what kind of hooked me. And it was, I think from that conversation, it was like, yep, we want to kind of like raise the voices of like black British women, but we also want to increase their visibility. And we didn't want the book to kind of go down the kind of like self-published route and it to be sidelined and, mm-hmm. and just and only live online. We wanted it to kind of like be a social media kind of campaign. And I think the name of the book was just perfect and timely, and like our social media strategy has just been like reinforced that as well. And I think the beauty of it is as well is like, though obviously I work in marketing, and I think the number one thing that we always said is we want people to feel something when they like any product, like yeah. we want them to actually, when they see this book, either be like, oh my god, this is amazing. Like, that was like the kind of end goal. And obviously just like, there's just been, everything we've done has been so strategic and it's been deliberate, and we're so lucky it's paying off, because when you see the Amazon charts and it's like, oh, we're number one, like it just makes everything really worth it. But there'll be times when we're just like, oh my god, we don't want to post, and like I would be like, oh, I can't, and Yomi would be like, no, we've got to do it. And I think that's the thing, like there's ideas and there's doing things, but I think what's really good about working on this with like Yomi, my best friend, and we're very different personalities in terms of how we work as well. Like she, like in terms of being very analytical and being very like dedicated, Yomi's very like that. Like she puts me back on the straight and narrow, because I can just be like, oh, theorizing for a long time and be like, oh, things have to look. But in terms of like, things have to be full, like we have to post four times a week, like four days a week, different articles, and like all of those sort of kind of like things. It's been, if it was left to me, sometimes I'll just be like, oh, we can miss a day. But having someone like you or me can just be who's on the straight and narrow is very, very like key to something being consistent. And I think that was the most important thing. We didn't just want to appear later on in like Elle magazine and like The Times and The Guardian and be like, oh, this is a book. We wanted to take people on a journey with us. And that was like a really key thing in kind of buying people in like, first and foremost, who these women are, who we are, who are just normal black girls essentially, and why this book is important. So it was like a really kind of like multi-layered strategy.
It's brilliant. Yomi, are you going to read a bit of the book for us?
I am.
This is like my favourite. Yeah. Like, she told me this story. She wasn't going to put this into the book, and she told me it, and I was like, this is so funny because it's so bad, but it's so funny.
I was like, is it that bad?
It was repressed memory. Honestly, she repressed it, but it's actually one of my favourite stories, and I can't believe she was not going to put it in a book, so please thank me.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Okay, so this is from a chapter called Being Susan Storm, which is in the sort of wider representation section of the book, which sort of looks at like media and stuff. So when I was in year six, my primary school put on a production of Grease. For many kids, including me, the prospect of missing lessons to wear a pink satin jacket and hand drive was as exciting as if the fake cigarettes we were fake smoking had been real. I leapt at the opportunity and went for the joint largest role, the archetypal white girl next door, Sandy. When auditions came around, I was confident. I knew I was unlikely to be scouted by Disney and carted onto their conveyor belt of terrifyingly precocious child stars, but I could dance, carry a tune, and show off a great deal, which, age 10, is essentially indistinguishable from acting. I learnt my lines, hit some notes, and strutted away, convinced that my performance had been enough for me to be crowned with the blonde wig of Miss Olsen. But I wasn't. I didn't get the part of Sandy. A blow supposedly softened by the silver lining of being given the role of resident bad gal, Rizzo. While anyone in their right mind knows that Rizzo is the true star of Grease, Sandy was simply a land aerial, giving up her legs for a bloke. But in her case, legs were a cardigan and good grades. She wasn't the biggest part, and the biggest part was meant to go to the person who had given the best audition. And I knew that person had been me. You might think that this is simply my embittered, self-aggrandizing interpretation, but it's not. You see, while talent is often subjective, the teacher's decision to cast a blonde-haired, blue-eyed schoolmate of mine and then rewrite the script so I had to sing Sandy's songs because she couldn't sing at all pretty much cemented my suspicion that the decision had been an aesthetic one. The girl who was chosen didn't have a single solo in the school musical, but boy, did she have a killer set of baby blues. This reverse Milli Vanilli routine was the first time I realised something that now barely raises an eyebrow for me. Black women's voices are wanted, but not if they come from our own mouths. If you look at the music charts, blue-eyed soul artists dominate simply because they sound like their black peers, who can't seem to catch a commercial break in the UK themselves. White artists are given award nods for sounds that not only came from black women, but also often regulate those women from outside the top 40. Similarly, white actors are able to flourish in their own countries first, while black actors must often achieve success overseas before they are championed at home. Thankfully, my singing and dancing dreams pretty much began and ended age 10. But for those who go on to follow them, the problem persists even when they do come true.
That's an incredible story.
Wow.
They rewrote the whole script.
They actually rewrote it. So I was like, hopelessly devoted. I was like, wait, Rizzo doesn't sing that. I was like, why am I singing this? Like, they literally rewrote it, so I had to sing it. It was crazy.
And I think a lot of different parts of the book, it's like a lot of it's repressed memories. It really that we is. Yeah. Yeah. Like, the writing process was just like, okay, we do the research, we do the interviews, but really, like, our personal experiences growing up, like, what was it like? And a lot of the time, it was like, everybody, you just don't really think about the larger impact of like the most minute little thing.
I didn't even think it was bad until Elizabeth was like, do you even have a clue how racist that is? I was like, really? I literally was like, but she did look more like Sandy. And Elizabeth was like, they rewrote the script.
Yeah, that's crazy. So that was just,
Because that's the thing, isn't it? That would have been quite like normal and okay to do that at that time. And I think what is brilliant now is that and just the way that the world is in terms of what we've got access to, is that we can put out these stories. Because I know we've had conversations with Natalie, and Natalie's told me lots of things that she's experienced as a black woman, and I just had no insight to that. So, you know, I know this book isn't written for me, but for me to read this book is really powerful because it gives me so many insights to things where you're like, oh my goodness, that totally went on. But you know, to just kind of get that another layer of understanding and awakeness around
absolutely.
What was it like for the both of you kind of bringing up those repressed memories? Do you think writing the books has changed you?
I was going to say, I think a lot of the time it was funny, and I know it shouldn't have been. I really don't think it shouldn't have been, but we did spend a lot of time laughing about stuff because it was just like, in hindsight, like there's a thing where Elizabeth like was talking to this guy and, you know, he was black as well, and he was supposed to take her to Nando's. This was like a big thing at the time when we were at university, and I was like, oh, he's
I was 18, guys.
She was 18. She was 18, you know. This is definitely not something she'd do now.
It wasn't rocker.
Yeah.
I'll decline of a rocker now. Like, Nando's was...
And me being like the... As Elizabeth said, very straight and narrow person I am. Like, at the time, I was like, he's not going to take you. He's not. And then she was like, oh, but he will. And then obviously, because men are... of course, you know how men can be. So he didn't. And then when she sort of, you know, quite rightfully sort of brought up her feelings of disappointment about it. And he was black as well. He literally said to her, oh, don't give me the black girl chat. That's what he said to her.
Yeah.
And it became this like running joke for us.
At
be, like,
uni.
At each other, like, don't give me the black girl chat.
Honestly.
So when we were writing it in the context of this book, it was like, oh, that was actually really bad.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, I think a lot of it was quite funny, but a lot of it was quite, I wouldn't say like traumatic, but it was a lot about like being grateful, I suppose, that you can have these realizations now that like you're so far from allowing those kind of things to happen.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
While you two are laughing at these absurd stories, I'm sort of just absolutely, you know, gobsmacked. But I wonder what the reaction has been to this book, because it's so empowering, but it's also kind of laying out these truths to people. You know, this happened, this happened, this happened. And these things are, you know, racism, whether that's a microaggression or, you know, written on the wall. How have people reacted to that? Because often when you speak out, you know, about feminism or racism, people aren't happy, and that's difficult. So I wonder if there's been anything like that.
Our kind of like demographic, like black girls, I think the number one reaction is, oh my God, like, yeah, this is, I'm glad it's actually in, not just online, but this is an actual book. And it's kind of validates their own experiences. And I think for everybody else, it's very much, like you said, oh my God, this stuff does exist. We're not making this stuff up. And I think that's what's powerful around the book. Because it's not just anecdote after anecdote. We tried our best to kind of weave in stats, and a lot of those stats were African-American stats, and we tried our best not to use those, and we tried to find stats in the UK. But one of the reasons why we've had to kind of really think, because a lot of the stats don't exist because people don't care enough. So when we're trying to work out, okay, what does this actually mean for black girls in the UK, there isn't enough. So I think a lot of it has been, I think people in our demographic, they definitely understand these things exist. And I think it kind of gives them the kind of sanity, like the kind of almost sanity checks that we talk about, not just calling up your best friend, but this is kind of like your other 39 or one of the most like trailblazing black women in the country are also validating your experiences, and there's stats to kind of prove it. This isn't just a chip on your shoulder. This is an actual real thing that happens. And I think for everybody else, it's kind of like almost looking in from the outside and going, oh, okay, so this actually does happen. And it's not just reduced to essentially just like, you know, personal experiences. Mm. We have stats in there that actually back up and research. And I think it's what's important is it's not just like, we just don't want this book to be like the first book and that's it. We want it to be this, you know, a floodgates to more books and more research and academics on these type of experiences. So
Were there any stats that shocked you? Was there anything you didn't know that when you're researching it, you were like, oh my gosh, I wasn't even aware of that?
I think, as I was saying before, there's stuff around, I mean, there's lots of stuff around health. Black women being more likely to have fibroids. A lot of the time that's linked to like chemical relaxer and like hair care treatments that are like not good for black hair. The statistics around like breast cancer. And then I think especially I'm always bringing up the statistics around dating, because I think a lot of black women have kind of assumed that or had some sort of ideas around that, but it's never been sort of concretely laid out that no, guys, this is actually real, in terms of being less likely to sort of receive matches on dating sites, being more likely to receive the cold shoulder. And I think what's really important to acknowledge about that is that it's from every single racial group, so that includes within our own community and from black men. And I think I think there were just loads of different things that just really sort of, whilst you kind of had ideas around it and kind of thought like, oh, maybe, you know, there's probably something in this, you didn't have the kind of statistical evidence that proved it. But yeah, we found a lot of stuff out that was just like absolutely mind-blowing, to be honest.
And so you've really, it feels like you've created a brand now from what I've seen across the media, across your socials and things. Have you got plans of what you're going to do next? Are you still kind of in this whirlwind of the book launch?
It's so weird because someone asked us a question the other day and they were like, did you ever think it was going to be as like big as this? Because it's me and Yomi, and we think so like if you could actually think about how we're very, very like, we were big dreamers. So honestly, in the depths and the depths and the depths, back in March 2015, before anything started, we definitely thought, we saw all this happening.
Yeah, we saw honestly, global.
We honestly did.
We really did.
Yeah.
But to see it, come out and like, you know, photo shoot after photo shoot, this after this, it's kind of like taking us aback a lot, because, and it's very much humbled us a lot. In terms of, I guess, like what's next, I think what's the beauty of what we've done is we've created like a real body of work that can be, you know, moved and like, you know, created in different platforms and doing different things as well. So I think it's got a really strong name. I think the most important thing on our minds at the moment is like, oh, we need a holiday because we're actually exhausted. But honestly, I think we're so keen to kind of like, you know, make sure that we're going to schools and like, you know, spread the message about what this book's about. But and also very much like go into like workplaces and kind of also do that. But from a brand level, yeah, we're just like really just want to have fun and just like, you know, whatever comes out of it, we're really, really excited.
And I think as Elizabeth was saying, we don't want this to be like the full stop of the conversation. We want it to sort of keep going and just we're just open to anything, to be honest.
Yeah,
so powerful. I'm just thinking of all the young girls as well who will read this, and that will change their future and the way that they're able to operate in the world. I think it's really exciting.
Thank you.
Do you think just kind of on where it goes next and what else you do with it, you said you wanted to go global. Do you think there is space for this? I'm thinking like in the US market.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like we're kind of like, those are the kind of conversations we're trying to push now. Yeah. Like we've already had interest from loads of different countries. And I think we met this girl from Portugal who was like, I'm reading this and you can just literally swap out the word Britain for Portugal, because yeah. she was like, it's exactly the same experience. So, and I think that's in any predominantly sort of white country where you are a minority, like it's really easily translatable. So yeah, we've had some interest in from like Brazil, like
yeah,
we sold the rights to Brazil, and apparently they really rarely make sort of offers of that the scale they did. Like then they're quite like conservative with, because it's not the richest of countries, so we were just so flattered that they were even interested. I definitely think that we've had so many messages from Americans being like, where's our version? We're like, we're coming. We're like staring at our agent, like, where is
honestly.
It? Like, yeah, honestly. But we've had a lot of interest from them, and we're kind of like, it's definitely something that we're sort of hoping will happen soon.
Absolutely.
Fingers crossed.
And you talked about there's lots of things that kind of came up for you in the book. So stats that you weren't aware of, things that you kind of repressed and hadn't thought about. If there were a couple of either stats or behaviours or facts that you think it's really important that everyone is aware of, what would they be?
Oh, that is such a big question.
It is such. I guess one thing that Elizabeth said in like another interview we did was just, if people can take, it's not really a stat or an anecdote or anything, but it's just a general message. Like, if there's one thing that people can take away from this book, it's just that the experiences, the lived experiences of Black women in this country are valid, and that they deserve to be heard, and that they're real. And I guess that's why we put so many anecdotes, not just from our lives, and then we sort of double down with that with like 39 like women who are incredible. A lot of them are recognisable, some aren't, but they're like amazing. And then we've doubled down on that with stats. It's very much just like we've put this together to be like, you know, obviously to show Black women themselves that, you know, you're not crazy, this isn't a chip on your shoulder, but then to show people outside of that, but you know, these are experiences worth listening to. And I'm always telling this anecdote that the other day when I opened Twitter, I had a notification from someone whose at was Fat White Bloke, and I was just like, oh, eye roll, what is this gonna be? He's gonna be like, oh, where's the white girl Bible, like, do you know what I mean? And then I literally opened it and he was like, just heard you guys on BBC Radio 4 and this is so important, I've learned so much about the Black female experience that I didn't know. And it's just like, that to me just completely sums up what we're trying to do. Like, somebody would act like that, and normally I'm like terrified they're gonna be like sending us racist abuse, but I think it just did what we hoped, which is just that to show that our experiences are real and they're valid.
Yeah. And I mean, that's such an amazing, wonderful so thing great. To hear, especially because we, you know, we expect the worst from Twitter. So that's a really nice story. But you've written the book in this really kind of accessible way. It's not this kind of steeped in, you know, academic language, and you know, the chapter headings, you know, are kind of related to UK garage, which is amazing. Obviously that was a kind of conscious decision, but you know, was that as a way of saying we're going to appeal to as many people as possible, and we want it to be relatable, and we don't want it to be kind of, you know, take it up to a level where, you know, for example, people like Sheryl Sandberg only speaking for, you know, this really niche group of people? And actually a lot of, you know, race texts, feminist texts are so academic that it's actually hard to penetrate. So was that part of the thought process?
Yeah, do you know what, I don't even think we thought about it like that at all, or I didn't. When we first wrote parts of like the sample chapter, our agent was very much like, okay, this is great, it needs some work, and the work that it needs is more of you guys' voices. Because we didn't necessarily think, oh, we need to kind of put ourselves in this at all. It wasn't about that. It was about the women. But our editor was very much like, okay, think, it was very much, we need your voices shine through throughout the whole, like, the text. So I think because of that, I mean, that's why it's quite authentic. And we were asked, like, we had an interview, and, like, they were like, oh, did you guys, like, was it put in their... using slang, was that deliberate? And it was very much because that's how we talk. We're like, honestly, girls from South London, we go to these corporate workplaces and go to these fancy networking events, but at the heart, we grew up in this literally in Peckham and Croydon, and that's, and our demographic, not necessarily all come from those areas, but they can definitely relate to just our very straight talking, like, just the way we are. And I think we tried our best to kind of put our personality as much as possible in the book, and I think that's why it's come out very accessible, because that's just honestly, like, and I think what's interesting is, well, I think loads of Black women were used to kind of, like, you know, learning, like, code switching and going from one environment and just seamlessly going to another environment and blending in and just, you know, switching it up. So I think it was really important for us to just be ourselves as much as possible, so they can read the book and see themselves in us, because that's honestly at the heart of what this book is.
Ladies, thank you so much for joining us. The book is brilliant. It's called Slay in Your Lane, The Black Girl Bible. It is out now. You can't miss it. It's a beautiful hot pink. Yomi Adegoke and Elizabeth Uvepa Benene, thank you so much for joining us. You have been brilliant and super inspiring.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
If people want to find you online, where should they be having a look?
At Slay in Your Lane. That's across the board. Because that's why we're like, we know we made this term up. Because it's like, we have both domains.co.uk.com, the Instagram, the Facebook, the Twitter. So yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Marketing for you.
Right?
Love it. Thank you so much.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
Kelly Lee is a singer-songwriter from South London. She released her debut solo single, Do You Want to Be Loved Like This, in February 2018. She's going to be performing that and bonus track, More Than Friends, for us now.
Yeah. Okay, let's take it away, Toby.
I often tell myself that we can be more than just friends. I know you think that if we move too soon, it will all end. I live in misery when you're not around. I won't be satisfied till we're taking those vows. I'm gonna be, cause I can't pretend. Don't you wanna be more than friends? What's it gonna be? Cause I can't pretend. Don't you wanna be more than friends? Hold me tight and don't let. I often fantasize the stars above our chair. They know my heart, it speaks to yours like only lovers do. If I could wear your clothes, I'd pretend I was you and lose control. There'll be some love making, heartbreaking, soul shaking love. Love making, heartbreaking, soul shaking. Because I can't pretend. Don't you wanna be more than friends? What's it gonna be? Because I can't pretend. Don't you wanna be more than friends? Hold me tight and don't let. Running in and out my life. It's got me so confused. We can make a sacrifice. Somebody's got to choose. We can make it if we try. For the sake of you and I. Together we can make it right. What's it gonna be? Yes. What's it gonna be? What's it gonna be? Be? Oh yeah. What's it gonna be? Yes. Oh yes. What's it gonna be? Cause I can't pretend. Don't you wanna be more than friends? What's it gonna be? Cause I can't pretend.
Your debut single is Do You Want to Be Loved Like This?
Yes, I released it on my own record label at the beginning of the year, in February. I decided to set up my own label and, yeah, release it. And actually, this is an exclusive for you guys. It's the first time I'm doing it acoustic, so.
Amazing.
Oh, we're so excited.
Yeah, let's do it.
Mama told me that he'd come and mess my mind. Oh, she told me. But he does a thing that makes me feel alive. Yeah, he knows me. He knows me. He got that thing that I need. He put that thing on me. Oh, body burning like fire. Got me screaming like a choir. He got me weak. To stay, my mind said leave. Oh, 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 oh. Then he says, oh, do you wanna be left like this? Yeah. Oh, do you wanna be left like this? Do you
and he says, oh, do you want to be left like this? Yeah. Oh, do you want to be left like this? Dear, 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 do you want to be left like this? Oh, yes. Do you want to be left like this? Does he even know how much I'm feeling? Ooh, my, oh my, I came this close to leaving, yes. Then he says, oh, do you want to be loved like this? Yeah, yes. Oh, do you want to be loved like this? Do ya? Do ya? Oh, 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 do you want to be loved like this? Yeah, yeah. Love like this, love like this, love like this. Oh, oh, oh. Do ya, do ya, do ya?
Kelly Lee saying, do you want to be loved like this? And before that, More Than Friends. Kelly, that was fantastic. Oh, we loved
you.
It.
Thank you for having me in the studio.
Oh, thanks for coming in. I was just reading your bio, and one thing that really struck me was that actually you have had number one singles. We have featured on all these number one singles, and you've never been credited for them. And now it feels like this is you being like, no,
yeah.
I'm taking the reins now.
Yeah, in 2014, I sang I Got You for Duke Dumont and Jax Jones, which went to number one. And then Second City's I Want to Feel, which went to number one. And then last year, More Than Friends went top 10 with James Hype, which was awesome. So, yeah, I'm an artist myself, but it's amazing that I sung those tracks. But yeah, it was kind of banging down some doors and going, hey, I'm here and I do me. And so the beginning of the year, decided to put out Do You Want to Be Loved Like This on my own label. And yeah, it's been really cool. It started trending in Dubai. I did a big show out there, Red Fest, and amazing. Just gearing up for my second single coming out soon.
And what's the second single called, so we can look out for it?
It's called Can't Dance. And we're just getting everything set up at the moment. I shot the video in Cape Town in South Africa, and I've kind of done this interesting contemporary dance piece, which I'm really excited for everybody to see. And so far we've been getting some really cool feedback, so it's been really exciting. And I had a new feature come out 2 weeks ago with Black Saint on Warner. That's called Don't Wreck My Holiday, and it was synced to Love Island last week. So it's like people have been...
We love a bit of Love Island on the show.
So yeah,
amazing.
And Kate, why does now feel like the time when you're like, hang on, I'm still knocking these doors, I'm here and I'm just going to do this myself? What was it that made you make that switch from helping everyone else out to being like, okay, now?
I think frustration. I mean, no sexism intended, but I know as women, we know that it does feel like we have to work 10 times harder a lot of time. And especially in the DJ producer world and dance music, it's all about male producer DJs and using a lot of female vocals and male vocals. Yeah. And yeah, I kind of was seen as a certain thing, and people were just wanting me to sing their hits. And when I was saying I'd do my own stuff, I wasn't really being listened to. So I thought, I'm not going to wait for someone else to allow me to put my music out. I'm going to put it out myself. And I'm really proud of Do You Want to Be Loved Like This. It's had, it was produced by James Hype, who I did More Than Friends with, and Eddie Jenkins. And we went in the studio and made a track for me. And yeah, I shot a video in one day in Dubai. And just, yeah, it's done just over 70,000 streams on Spotify with no Spotify playlist at all. So I'm just so proud of that. And it's just now about me growing and the journey and just going, hey, I'm here. I've sung these tracks. You know my voice, but now get to know me.
And what is your goal for the rest of the year? What would you like to see happen?
I'd love to see some Spotify support for my next single, because I'm not with a major label. As I'm with my own label, I need to meet someone magic at Spotify. So if anyone at Spotify is listening, that'd be awesome.
Who do we know? We must know someone at Spotify.
I used to know the marketing director.
Oh, there we go.
Work
that out.
Okay. We'll do some tweeting for you.
Yeah, thank you. But then I've got shows coming up the rest of the year. I'm performing at Boardmasters, Manchester Pride main stage. I love all the Pride events. Did Birmingham Pride earlier on the year and Edinburgh Pride. And they're a really big supporter of me, my LGBTQ fan base. And I've got Sundown Festival. And at the end of the year, I'll be going back to the UAE and doing some shows myself. I think we've got a headline one that we're discussing at that moment. So
great.
Yeah, it's going to be getting on the road, doing more shows and doing some more acoustic things with Awesome Toby, like here. smashed it. So yeah.
Well, we have loved listening to you. Your voice absolutely blows away, and you've just given us all such a lift at the end of the show.
Thank you for coming to do that.
If people want to hear more from you, where should they be looking?
Check me out on Instagram, Twitter. I'm Kelly Lee UK, and on Spotify, just search Kelly-Lee. So that's me, and you'll find my music there.
Yes, and Spotify. Give us some promo. That's what we want, please. So we are nearly at the end of our show. But before we go, it's time for our Badass Principle of the Week, but we haven't thought of one, Emma, have we?
We haven't. But I'm really inspired by Kelly. Like, you know, she wanted to put her album music out there, and she's like, do you know what? I'm just going to set up my own label. So I think the Badass Principle of the Week should be just do it. Because also we had the ladies from Slay in Your Lane, and they had an idea and they made it happen. So I think that's the Badass Principle of the Week.
Make it happen. 1, 2, 3, 4! This has been the Badass Women's Hour podcast. We hope you've loved it as much as we do. If you did, rate and review us, give us 5 stars, and then come have a chat with us at Badass Women's Hour HR on all the socials. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, you name it, we're there.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.